Have you ever listened to your absolute favorite hit song?
Oh, sure.
You know, the one where you know every single word, you've blasted it in your car on the highway 100 times.
Right, rolling the windows down.
Exactly. And you just naturally assume that their artist, whose name is glowing on the album cover, wrote and played every single note.
Yeah, you picture them in this dimly lit room, right?
Right. Just pouring their soul into the guitar, hammering away at the drums, laying down this incredible bass line.
It's a great image.
It is. But today, we are completely shattering that illusion.
We really are. I mean, it is a beautiful illusion, a very romantic idea of how music is actually made.
Yeah.
But the reality behind those recordings, like the actual physical and psychological process of creating a hit record, it's infinitely more fascinating.
Absolutely.
And it involves this completely different, mostly invisible cast of characters.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're taking you into the hidden, highly pressurized, and frankly, kind of mind-blowing world of the contemporary studio
It's
guitarist.
a crazy world.
It really is. And we got our hands on this incredible new research out of the University of Illinois.
Yeah, this just came out, right?
Literally just published in April 2026. It's a doctoral dissertation by researcher Luis Alberto Rodriguez Gomes da Silva. It's titled The Contemporary Studio Guitarist: Practices and Adaptability. And honestly, what this research found completely changes how you'll listen to the radio from now on.
What's really brilliant about Da Silva's research is that it refuses to just look at, the literal notes these musicians play.
Right, it's not just a theory textbook.
No, not at all. It goes incredibly deep into the psychology, the extreme adaptability, and the technological fluency required to actually survive in this job.
Because being a studio guitarist is absolutely not about who can play the fastest, flashiest solo.
Which is such a common misconception.
Yeah, you think professional guitar player and you instantly think of someone standing on a monitor wedge at a stadium.
Right, shredding a million notes a minute while, like, pyrotechnics go off in the background.
Exactly, but in the studio, that guy is usually a massive liability.
Oh, a total liability. The actual job is about being this invisible, load-bearing backbone of the entire music industry.
So we are going to unpack the myths, the insane gear requirements, the mind-reading psychology, and just the sheer survival skills required to be the person a producer calls.
Especially when millions of dollars are on the line.
Yeah, and the studio clock is ticking at what, $500 an hour?
Easily.
Okay, let's unpack this. Before we look at what these musical chameleons do today with all their laptops and digital gear, we kind of have to understand how this role was even created in the first place.
Right, the history.
Yeah, where did the session player actually come from?
To really grasp the origins of this job, we have to rewind to the period right after World War II.
Okay, setting the scene.
You had this massive, unprecedented post-war economic boom in the United States. And with that economic surplus comes an absolute explosion in the demand for recorded music.
And audio entertainment in general, right?
Exactly. It wasn't just records. Suddenly, you have a boom in television advertisements, massive radio syndication, sweeping film scores,
Just a tidal wave of content.
and major record labels like Capitol, Warner, and RCA are tasked with churning out this content at a literal industrial scale.
So it's essentially an assembly line for audio.
Pretty much. They needed armies of musicians to keep up with the sheer volume.
Because you had these massive megastars emerging: Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra, Peggy Lee.
Right.
But obviously, Elvis isn't playing the upright bass on his own records.
No.
And Sinatra certainly isn't sitting behind the drum kit.
Exactly. These major labels operated massive in-house recording studios. Think of like Capitol Records' famous cylindrical building in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah, the iconic tower.
With those underground echo chambers and huge tracking rooms.
Yeah.
And the executives realized very quickly that they couldn't just rely on a rotating random cast of street musicians.
Or even the artist's own touring bands.
Right, if they wanted to maintain a really high level of sonic quality and, more importantly, efficiency.
Because time was literally money.
Exactly. So they started retaining pools of highly skilled, deeply reliable musicians, the first session players.
And right in the middle of this post-war boom, in the early 1950s, a technological earthquake happens that completely upends the hierarchy of these studio
The
orchestras.
electric guitar revolution.
Yes. But hold on. Let's really define what that revolution was.
Unquote.
Because I think people assume the electric guitar was just, an acoustic guitar made louder so it could be heard over a drum set.
A lot of people think that.
But it was so much more than just a volume knob, right?
Right? It was a fundamental reshaping of the sonic landscape.
Wow.
When the solid body electric guitar like the Fender Telecaster or the Gibson Les Paul was mass produced, it didn't just amplify sound, it changed the physical properties of the audio.
You look at figures like Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, Little Richard's guitarists.
Yeah.
They weren't just holding a piece of wood with strings. They were introducing entirely new textures to the human ear.
They discovered that if you push an amplifier past its intended limit, the sound wave distorts.
It breaks up.
Exactly. You get feedback. You get this aggressive, biting tone.
So they basically changed how music was physically experienced by the listener.
Completely. It went from this polite acoustic background sound of the big band era to something that could literally vibrate your chest cavity.
And because of that visceral physical reaction, the electric guitar became the defining voice of this emerging rebellious thing called rock and roll.
Right. And the demand for guitarists who could wrangle this new technology in these sterile studio settings absolutely skyrocketed.
But what the dissertation points out as being really crucial to understand here is who was actually playing on the vast majority of these records as we move into the 1960s and 70s.
We're talking about the legendary collectives.
The shadow bands.
Yes. You had these incredible localized groups of musicians who played on almost everything.
Like the Wrecking Crew out in Los Angeles.
Booker T and the MGs in Memphis. The Nashville A-Team.
Oh, and the Funk Brothers holding down the entire Motown sound in Detroit.
And the Muscle Shoals rhythm section down in Alabama.
These weren't just hired hands who showed up, read a piece of sheet music, collected a check, and left.
No, they were essentially the house bands that architected the actual sound of the greatest hits of the era.
So when you hear California Dreamin' by the Mamas and the Papas, or Patsy Cline's Crazy, or Aretha Franklin's Respect.
Yeah.
You aren't hearing the touring bands of those artists.
Not at all.
You are hearing these specific, tight-knit groups of studio musicians who basically lived in these rooms together.
And here's the most vital insight from Da Silva's research regarding these early collectives.
Okay.
These players were almost never formal academics.
Wait, really?
Yeah. They didn't come out of prestigious ivory tower conservatories with degrees in music theory or composition.
Wait, stop right there. I have to challenge that.
Go for it.
If they are literally inventing the most important, culturally dominant music of the 20th century, how do they not have formal training?
I know, it sounds crazy.
Shouldn't the record labels, who are protecting millions of dollars in investments, be hiring the top Juilliard graduates to ensure no mistakes are made?
It's a completely logical assumption, but it ignores the reality of what pop music was at the time.
How so?
A Juilliard graduate in 1962 might be able to flawlessly sight read a complex violin concerto. But if you ask them to invent a gritty, syncopated rock and roll groove behind a soul singer...
Oh, they'd freeze.
They would completely freeze. There was no sheet music for rock and roll. There were no textbooks on how to play funk.
So how did they do it? If they weren't studying this in a classroom, how did they become the architects of modern music?
They succeeded through intense, active listening, and incredibly fluid adaptation.
Trial by fire.
Exactly. They learned their craft on the bandstand, in sweaty, crowded clubs, and by obsessively listening to records and copying what they heard.
Wow.
They developed this incredible, almost supernatural ability to drop into a studio, hear a rough acoustic demo, or just a singer humming an idea.
Just a hum.
Yeah, and instantly translate it into a polished, stylistically perfect, full band arrangement.
That blows my mind. It's like trying to build an airplane while you're already falling out of the sky.
That's a perfect analogy.
But how do you train for that? If there is no manual for how to invent rock and roll accompaniment, what are they relying on?
They were relying on their ears, their instincts, and their collective musical vocabulary.
Right.
And that lack of rigid academic training among these greats actually fostered the very skills they needed most.
The ability to improvise.
Yes. The ability to interpret feeling rather than just executing written instructions.
Which brings us to a massive myth that this dissertation completely busts.
Oh, a huge one.
I think most people, and you listening might assume this too, think that a top-tier studio pro today is basically a human sheet music scanner.
Right, like a robot.
You put a piece of paper with thousands of black dots in front of them, and their eyes just perfectly translate that into complex finger movements in real time.
But the research completely deconstructs this assumption.
It absolutely tears it down. The dissertation makes it very clear. Sight reading is not the ultimate gatekeeper of the studio world.
Now, to be fair and nuanced, it is a highly valuable skill.
Sure, especially in orchestral film scoring.
Exactly. But it is not the universal prerequisite for pop and rock success that many academic institutions make it out to be.
There's a great quote in the text from Chris Standring, a veteran session guitarist and composer.
Oh, I love this part.
He points out that if a composer drops the equivalent of a highly complex Bach fugue in front of a studio player, they absolutely do not expect it to be played perfectly on site.
That's just not how it works in the real world.
Standring notes that if a composer actually wants the best possible performance of something that intricate, something that requires specific fingerings and deep muscle memory, they will send the sheet music to the player ahead of time.
Because they don't want a cold reading, they want a musical performance.
Right. He says, and this is the crux of the argument, the dots on the page are merely a means to an end. It is the performance that counts.
The dots on the page are merely a means to an end.
But hang on, I'm stuck on this.
What's the sticking point?
If the sheet music is just a suggestion or a basic roadmap, what happens when the music is really simple?
Okay.
I mean, a lot of pop music is just three or four basic chords. Why couldn't a standard, well-trained sight reader just nail it instantly and save everyone time?
That's a fair question.
Why is the ear so supreme if the harmonic math is that simple?
Because you aren't just playing math. You are playing to a specific, often unspoken, human context.
Mm-hmm.
Let me break down the difference using an interview from the dissertation with a veteran Chicago session guitarist named Craig McCreary.
Okay, the jingle guy.
Yeah, he did a massive amount of commercial jingle work, especially in the 1980s and 90s when the guitar was absolutely everywhere on television commercials.
Oh man, the golden age of the soaring guitar solo and a truck commercial.
Exactly. And McCreary explicitly says in his interview, the ear thing saved you a lot. Because his experience perfectly illustrates the reality of the job. He points out that, harmonically speaking, a lot of the commercial jingle work he did was actually quite simple.
Like three major chords. Very basic scales.
Right. So again, why not just read it off the page?
Yeah, exactly.
Because the music had to perfectly match the visual cues of a television commercial on a screen in front of them.
Oh, the timing.
You have a 30-second spot. The car drives off the cliff at exactly 2.4 seconds.
Okay.
The company logo appears at exactly 14.8 seconds.
Wow. Precision.
So the time signatures the composer wrote to match those visual hits would be incredibly tricky.
How tricky are we talking?
You might have a measure of 44 time, followed by a measure of 78 time, followed by a measure of 54 time.
Just to force the musical accent to land exactly when the car door slams on screen.
Exactly.
Oh, wow. Okay, so the chords are simple, but the rhythm is a mathematical nightmare.
Total nightmare.
It's constantly shifting underneath you like a treadmill, changing speeds randomly.
That is a great way to put it. And in a fast-paced studio environment where you might only have an hour to record the entire track before the next client comes in,
yeah,
a flawless robotic reading of a complex rhythm chart is completely useless if it doesn't have the right feel.
Right, because if you are staring at the paper and counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in your head, you're going to sound stiff.
The music still has to groove. It still has to evoke an emotion that makes the viewer want to buy the truck.
So a player with a highly trained ear can listen to the drum track, internalize that bizarre shifting time signature intuitively, and respond musically in the moment.
Exactly. They feel the pulse rather than just mathematically executing the dots on the page.
The ear allows the guitarist to hear the nuance that simply cannot be written on a piece of paper.
Yes. You can write a quarter note on a page, but you can't write how that quarter note should feel.
Like, how hard is the drummer hitting their snare?
Or where is the bass player placing the groove? Are they playing slightly ahead of the metronome click to make it feel urgent?
Or are they dragging lazily behind it to make it feel heavy?
Exactly. The visual processing center of your brain, staring at paper, can't compute groove.
The auditory center does.
The ability to internalize material by ear allows the player to lock in and respond to the human element in the room.
Okay, so if they are just staring intensely at sheet music, what exactly are they listening for when they walk into a session?
That is the big question.
They are listening to figure out exactly which musical costume they need to put on for that specific artist.
A costume is the perfect metaphor. In fact, the concept of the studio player as a chameleon comes up repeatedly in De Silva's research.
A chameleon?
Yeah. James Burton, who is absolute royalty in both the early rock and country worlds, he was the legendary guitarist for Ricky Nelson and later Elvis Presley's TCB band. He used the exact word.
And Brent Mason too, right?
Yes. Brent Mason, who is arguably the most recorded first call guitarist in modern Nashville history, also uses the term chameleon to describe his entire career ethos.
And then the dissertation quotes Andrew Sinoviak, a massive modern-day Los Angeles session player.
What did he say?
He has this amazing description. He says the modern player has to be a Rolodex of
A
sounds.
Rolodex of sounds. I love
I
that.
love that imagery too. He says, press a button and he sounds like Brent Mason. Press another button and he sounds like Slash.
You have to be able to instantly manifest an entirely different musical identity based on the producer's whim.
But here is the psychological question. How does a human being actually develop a Rolodex of authentic musical identities?
Because you can't fake it.
No, if you try to fake a country twang or a blues shuffle, the producer will hear it instantly.
They'll spot a phony immediately. The research points to the immense value of a diverse, wildly cross-pollinated musical upbringing.
So they didn't just listen to one type of music.
Right. These players did not grow up in a sterile bubble listening to only one genre.
Take Albert Lee, for example.
Oh, legendary guitarist.
Played with Eric Clapton, Emmylou Harris, the Everly Brothers. The guy was born in England, grew up in a gypsy family, and just absorbed this massive, eclectic variety of European and American musical styles purely by ear before he ever set foot in a major American recording
He
studio.
was a sponge.
A total
Or
sponge.
look at Craig McCreary again, the jingle player we mentioned.
Right.
He grew up in the Midwest, deeply immersed in the blues and the heavy psychedelic rock of bands like Cream.
So he was a rocker.
He spent his teenage years obsessing over Eric Clapton's playing, literally copying every vibrato and string bend off the vinyl records.
Oh, I bet that came in handy.
It did. When he got into doing commercial jingles in Chicago in the 1980s, that specific screaming rock vocabulary was exactly what the ad agencies suddenly wanted.
He could pull from that deep well of teenage obsession and apply it perfectly to a 30-second car commercial, giving it genuine rock credibility.
It's all about what raw ingredients you bring to the room.
But how do those ingredients actually interact when you put multiple chameleons in the same studio?
The dissertation highlights a brilliant anecdote from Hal Blaine that perfectly captures this.
Oh, Hal Blaine.
Now, for the listener, Hal Blaine was the core drummer for the Wrecking Crew in LA.
The guy is an absolute legend.
The man played on over 35,000 recording sessions,
35,000.
150 top 10 hits, the Ronettes, the Beach Boys, Simon and Garfunkel. He is arguably the foundational pulse of 20th century American pop music.
So, what did Blaine say about the dynamic in those rooms?
Blaine talked about the specific volatile chemistry of those early Wrecking Crew sessions.
Volatile.
Yeah, he said that when they recorded, they intentionally had guys from totally different musical backgrounds colliding in real time.
Oh, like a mashup.
Exactly. The core rhythm section guys on bass and keys who had deep jazz backgrounds would provide this incredibly solid, sophisticated, constant
They
tempo,
were the anchor.
right? Playing with immense restraint and harmonic knowledge. But then the producers would bring in the country and rockabilly guys to play the lead guitars.
Players like Glen Campbell and James Burton.
Exactly.
Wait, why would you put a country picker in a room with a smooth jazz rhythm section to record a pop song?
It sounds counterintuitive, right?
That sounds like a recipe for a train wreck.
It sounds like a clash, but it was actually alchemy.
Wow.
Blaine explicitly notes that the country guys brought what he called wild off-the-wall solos that nobody in the jazz or traditional pop world had ever heard before.
They used bending strings, aggressive finger picking, raw energy.
And the jazz guys held the structural foundation, making the track feel sophisticated and radio-friendly.
While the country guys brought the raw fire and unpredictability.
Blaine argues that blending these totally different musical traditions together on a single piece of analog tape is literally what created the fresh, explosive sound of 1960s rock and roll records.
It was the friction between restraint and wildness.
Absolutely.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because being a chameleon isn't just a state of mind.
No, it's very physical.
It's not just about having a broad record collection or a cool backstory. To physically achieve these different sounds, to press the button and sound like Slash versus Brent Mason, requires an encyclopedic, almost scientific knowledge of physical gear.
It is highly technical work.
You have to understand the physics of amplifiers, the circuitry of pedals, and deeply specific stylistic rules.
Every musical genre has an anatomical structure, and a studio guitarist has to know the exact physical anatomy of the genre they are hired to play, down to the millimeter of the string gauge.
Let's do a really deep dive into this anatomy, because this is where the genius of the studio player really shines.
Let's just do it.
The dissertation breaks down the exact physical and technical requirements for different types of sessions, and it is fascinating.
Where should we start?
Let's start with jazz. If a producer calls a player and says, "Give me an authentic old school swing jazz feel for this track," what is the guitarist physically doing to their instrument before they even play a note?
First, the entire gear setup changes.
Goodbye, rock gear.
Exactly. You are immediately putting away the solid body rock guitars, no Stratocasters, no Les Pauls.
What do they use instead?
For authentic swing jazz, think the Count Basie era or a Michael Bublé throwback track. You need a large hollow body guitar, usually an archtop.
Okay.
And you are strictly stringing it with heavy gauge strings, often flat wound strings, which are polished smooth.
Explain the physics of that to me. Why heavy, smooth strings? If you want to play fast, shouldn't you use light strings?
Because in this specific genre, you aren't trying to bend the strings to wail like a blues player.
Ah.
Bending a heavy string is physically painful and structurally counterproductive here. You want a thick, warm, incredibly flat tone with a robust bass response.
So the heavier string helps with that.
Yes. The heavy strings require more physical force to vibrate, which produces a louder, rounder, fundamental pitch with fewer messy overturns.
The goal is for the guitar to blend seamlessly into the acoustic environment of the other instruments in the room, like the upright bass, the piano, and the brass section.
It needs to sound like polished wood, not screaming metal.
And the technique itself is incredibly specific, right? The text talks about the four on the floor Freddie Green style.
Yes, Freddie Green.
For the listener, Freddie Green was the legendary rhythm guitarist for the Count Basie Orchestra for 50 years. He basically invented this job.
He really did. In the Freddie Green style, the guitarist's job is explicitly not to play flashy solos.
None at all.
It's also not to play dense, complex chords that cover all six strings, because that will clash with the piano player's left hand.
Oh, that makes sense.
The goal is purely rhythmic propulsion. You play small, tightly voiced chords, usually just three notes, squarely on every single beat. One, two, three, four.
But wait, if they are just playing squarely on the beat, how does it not sound like a rigid, boring march?
This is where the profound psychological and mathematical trick of jazz comes in, which De Silva details beautifully.
I love this part.
Even if the sheet music is written in a straight 44-time signature, meaning a simple grid of four beats to a measure, the guitarist has to internally, mentally feel it as a 128 swing.
Break that down for me. What does 128 feel like compared to 44?
Imagine 44 time as a ticking clock. Tick, tick, tick.
Like a metronome.
Right. It is perfectly divided into halves. Now imagine 128 time. Instead of dividing the beat in half, you were dividing it into triplets.
One, two, three, two, two, three.
Exactly. One, two, three, two, two, three, three, two, three, four, two, three. It gives the underlying rhythm a rolling, skipping, circular feel rather than a rigid, linear march.
Ah, so it breathes.
It breathes. Furthermore, to make it really swing, the guitarist must utilize a micro-timing technique called playing behind the beat.
Playing behind the beat, so they are intentionally playing late. Like out of time.
Not out of time, but just a microscopic fraction of a second late relative to the drummer's cymbal strike. Mm-hmm. We are talking milliseconds.
Wow, that requires immense physical control.
It really does. When you place your chord just slightly after the mathematical center of the beat, it creates this incredible sense of relaxation, of leaning back in your chair.
But paradoxically, because the listener's ear expects the beat to land precisely on the grid, delaying it slightly creates tension.
The listener's brain leans forward, waiting for it. That tension creates an undeniable forward motion. It physically pulls the listener along.
If you play perfectly, mathematically, on the grid in jazz, it sounds completely stiff and lifeless.
The magic is in the human imperfection of the micro delay.
That is mind-blowing. The math of groove.
It's beautiful.
Okay, so that's the acoustic warmth, the heavy strings, and the subtle micro-timing of jazz. Let's pivot and talk about contemporary rock.
A total 180.
Because honestly, I can completely geek out over this era. We are talking about the 1980s. Huge hair, massive stadium drum sounds, and absolute studio guitar heroes like Steve Lukather from Toto and Dan Huff.
Dan Huff seemingly played on every single hit record out of Nashville and LA for a decade.
The aesthetic and physical expectations for contemporary rock are the exact polar opposite of jazz.
Right. Instead of a warm, blending, hollow body,
yeah,
you are relying on highly saturated, overdriven, screaming, distorted guitar tones.
And the gear recipe is iconic. To get that massive 80s studio rock sound, veteran player Chris Standring outlines a very specific physical setup.
What's the setup?
You take a solid body guitar, usually a Gibson Les Paul with humbucker pickups, or a Fender Stratocaster. You run it through a classic tube amp, traditionally a Marshall stack pushed to its absolute limit.
So loud.
And then, to make the sound wide so it fills the arena, you add a stereo chorus effect.
Oh, the chorus pedal. For the listener who might not know what a chorus effect physically does,
yeah,
it takes your guitar signal, copies it, slightly detunes the copy so it's a tiny bit flat or sharp, delays it by a few milliseconds, and splits it into the left and right speakers.
It tricks the human ear into thinking two massive guitars are playing simultaneously.
It sounds huge.
And the final secret sauce for that specific, soaring, Steve Lukather-led sound, you add a digital delay pedal set to exactly 500 milliseconds with a long feedback trail of about 4 or 5 repeats.
That specific delay time perfectly syncs up with the mid-tempo power ballads of the era.
That is the literal mathematical formula for 1980s arena rock grandeur.
It is.
But here is the most fascinating analytical point from the text, and it's something I had never considered.
The harmony, right?
Yes. When you use that much heavy distortion, you actually have to completely change the chords you are allowed to play.
This is a brilliant intersection of the physics of sound and music theory. The dissertation explains the literal why behind rock harmony.
Tell me.
Let's look at what distortion physically is. When you play guitar cleanly, the sound wave is a smooth, rolling sine wave.
Like ocean waves.
Right. But when you plug into a Marshall amp and crank the volume to 10, the amplifier's tubes cannot handle the amount of electrical voltage you are sending them.
They overload.
They physically cannot reproduce the top and bottom of that sine wave.
So the wave gets chopped off.
Exactly. It's called clipping. The top and bottom of the smooth wave are sheared off, turning it into a harsh, jagged square wave.
A square wave.
And this clipping generates intense, aggressive harmonic overtones. Now, if you try to play the complex, tightly clustered chords used in jazz chords with 4, 5, or 6 different notes ringing out through a distorted amp, those jagged square waves literally crash into each other in the amplifier circuitry.
It's like trying to shove 3 thick, different colored layers of paint onto a canvas before the first one dries. It just immediately turns into a giant smear of brown mud.
A perfect analogy. In audio engineering, this is called intermodulation distortion.
The text refers to them as sonic artifacts, right?
Yes. The mathematical frequencies of the different notes fright each other, creating bizarre, phantom, low-frequency hums and screeching highs.
So the human ear simply cannot distinguish the original notes anymore.
No, it just sounds like a chaotic, angry wall of noise.
So if the gear physically prevents you from playing complex chords, what do the rock players do?
They practice what is called harmonic simplification.
They strip the chord back to its most basic foundational elements.
Yes.
How exactly do they simplify it? Which notes get cut?
They drop the third.
The third.
In Western music theory, a standard chord is built on a root note, a third, and a fifth. The third note of the scale is the crucial identifier. It determines whether a chord is major, sounding happy and triumphant, or minor, sounding sad and dark.
But the frequency of the third creates the most severe clashing when subjected to heavy distortion.
Right. So studio rock guitarists will routinely omit the third entirely from their chord voicings. They play just the root note and the fifth note.
The classic power chord.
Exactly. The power chord is not just a stylistic choice. It is a physical necessity born from the limitations of the amplifier.
By emphasizing just the root and the fifth, they maintain immense structural stability and raw power.
They avoid all the muddy sonic artifacts while letting the intense overtone series of the distortion provide all the necessary texture and aggression.
It's a masterclass in adapting to the physics of your gear.
It really is.
That is absolutely brilliant. It's not that rock players are dumb and don't know complex jazz chords. It's that the actual physics of the electrons in their equipment forbids them from using them.
They have to play power chords.
Now let's contrast that massive 80s heavy rock with what the text calls authentic rock from the 50s and 60s, and also funk.
Because they are totally different beasts.
And require completely different gear setups.
Very different. If a producer hires you to play an authentic 50s rock and roll track or a retro 60s British invasion style song, you absolutely cannot show up with a heavily distorted 1980s Marshall stack and a chorus pedal.
If you do, you will be fired.
On the spot.
Yay.
You have to honor the historical sonic aesthetics of the era.
You have to bring out the jumbo hollow body guitars again. A Gibson ES-175 or a Gibson ES-335, maybe an old Gretsch like George Harrison played.
Right.
And instead of high-gain amplifier stacks, you are plugging into classic open-backed combo amps like Fender Twin Reverbs or Vox AC-30s.
And the crucial difference, you aren't using heavy square wave distortion.
You are just turning the amplifier up loud enough until it bites.
Bite, or edge of breakup, is the perfect term. It's the sound of the amplifier's vacuum tubes just beginning to sweat, but not fully clipping yet.
It is a highly dynamic tone.
Because it isn't fully compressed by distortion, the amp responds dramatically to exactly how hard the player hits the strings with their pick.
If you brush the string softly, the chord sounds pristine and clean.
But if you dig in and strike the strings violently, the tubes saturate, and it produces a nasty, aggressive bark.
It puts the control of the tone entirely in the physical hands of the player.
And harmonically, to be authentic, the guitarist is living almost exclusively inside the minor pentatonic and blues scales. That is the historical vocabulary.
Okay, what about funk?
Funk.
This is one of my favorite topics because funk music is so famously dense.
It's a pack.
You've got popping bass lines driving the low end, blazing brass sections, a drummer playing complex syncopated hi-hat patterns, maybe a clavinet or a Hammond B3 organ taking up the entire mid-range.
It is a very, very crowded room sonically.
An incredibly crowded room.
If you look at an audio spectrum analyzer of a funk track, almost every frequency band is completely full.
So where does the guitar go?
Well, in funk, if the guitar player hits a big, wide, ringing rock chord, they will instantly ruin the mix.
They will mask the horns and clash with the keyboards.
The guitar has to fit into a tiny, surgically precise sonic space.
The dissertation highlights Dennis Coffey, one of the legendary funk brothers who played on countless Motown hits. He famously used the wah-wah pedal.
Yes.
Explain how that works in this context.
A wah-wah pedal is essentially a sweeping frequency filter. When you rock your foot back and forth on the pedal, it isolates and boosts a very narrow band of frequencies, usually in the high mid-range, while cutting out the bass in the extreme treble. This allows the guitar to carve out a very specific, sharp sonic space that cuts right through the dense mix of the horns and the bass without stepping on anyone's toes.
But the physical technique of funk is the really mind-blowing part. The guitar basically stops being a guitar, right?
Yes. In funk, the guitar essentially ceases to be a harmonic instrument and becomes a percussion instrument.
The drum layer.
Exactly. The guitarist is locking in with the drum kit. They use tightly articulated, highly staccato chords.
Meaning the left hand presses the strings down just long enough to sound the chord and then instantly releases the pressure to choke the notes off before they can ring out.
It creates a sharp bap sound. Or they use what we call muted string percussive rhythms.
What does that look like physically?
The guitarist's right hand is constantly aggressively strumming up and down in a 16th note pattern, but the left hand is just resting lightly over the strings, blocking them from vibrating.
So no actual pitch rings out at all.
Just the rhythmic, metallic, chicka-chicka scratch of the pick hitting the dead strings.
They are functioning purely as a rhythmic layer, locking perfectly in time with the drummer's hi-hat and snare drum, propelling the groove forward without muddying the harmony.
It's purely rhythmic.
Wow. Okay, two more genres to deeply dissect because the contrast is just amazing. Let's look at country and classical.
Okay, let's go to Nashville.
First, let's talk about the Nashville sound.
Country music is one of the most commercially robust and standardized recording genres in the world, and it provides massive, steady employment for studio guitarists who can master its incredibly strict rules.
The aesthetic here is heavily defined by pioneers like Albert Lee and James Burton and modern masters like Brent Mason.
Yes.
So what's the strict gear recipe for country? I imagine you can't bring a Marshall stack to Nashville either.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
The setup is famously minimal, but it is a completely terrifyingly unforgiving.
Why terrifying?
You want a biting, treble-heavy, twangy sound that can slice right through a dense mix of acoustic guitars, fiddles, and pedal steel. Mm-hmm. The absolute standard weapon of choice is the Fender Telecaster, a solid plank of ash wood. And crucially, you use the electronic pickup closest to the metal bridge of the guitar, which produces the sharpest, most treble-dominant tone.
You run that Telecaster straight into a very clean, high headroom amplifier, usually a Fender, maybe with a little splash of spring reverb.
Right. But there is a secret, mandatory weapon the text mentions that every country studio player relies on.
The compressor pedal.
Yes. Dynamic compression is vital to achieving the modern country sound.
Explain the compressor pedal to me like I'm a complete idiot.
Okay, I'll try.
How does it actually work, and why do country players need it so desperately when jazz players don't use it at all?
Think of a compressor as an invisible, microscopic sound engineer whose only job is to ride the volume fader of your guitar at lightning speed.
Okay.
Mechanically, it evens out the dynamic range of an audio signal. It takes the loudest transient peaks, like when you strike a string incredibly hard with a thick plastic pick, and it squashes that volume down.
And the quiet stuff?
Simultaneously, it takes the quietest notes, like a soft finger pluck or a hammer-on, and it boosts that volume up.
So it takes the mountains and the valleys of your volume and pushes them all toward the middle.
Everything comes out in a relatively uniform, punchy volume.
Correct. And this is absolutely essential for a country guitar because of a core physical technique called chicken picking.
I love that term, chicken picking.
What is happening with the hands during chicken picking?
It's a highly rhythmic hybrid picking technique. The guitarist holds a traditional hard plastic flat pick between their thumb and index finger to strike the bass strings.
Got it.
But simultaneously, they're using the flesh and fingernails of their middle, ring, and pinky fingers to aggressively snap and pluck the higher strings.
It creates this incredibly sharp, percussive, clucking sound, hence chicken picking.
But wait, if you are using soft human flesh and fingernails to pluck some strings, alongside a hard piece of plastic striking other strings, the physical volumes of those different strikes would naturally be wildly uneven, right?
The plastic pick would be way louder than the finger pluck.
Exactly. And on a modern pop country radio track, you can't have notes disappearing into the mix.
The compressor pedal acts as a safety net.
It ensures that the quiet, fleshy finger plucks and the aggressive, hard plastic pick strikes are outputted to the amplifier at the exact same volume level.
Furthermore, because the compressor is squashing the initial attack of the note, it artificially sustains the ringing of the string, giving the notes this incredible, polished, ringing pop that defines modern country lead playing.
Combine that heavily compressed tone with the constant use of double stops, which is playing specific intervals like thirds and sixths simultaneously to mimic a pedal steel guitar, and you have the complete anatomy of country guitar.
All right, finally, let's talk about classical guitar in a studio setting. This is a total curveball in the dissertation.
It really is, and it highlights the extreme boundaries of the profession.
In fact, veteran player Chris Standring notes that if a producer needs a truly authentic, complex, classical performance, say, for a sweeping cinematic film score, they will usually just hire a dedicated conservatory-trained classical specialist.
The physical technique is simply too specialized for a rock or pop player to fake.
But the text notes that sometimes a session pop player is asked to do it, usually just to add a specific romantic classical flavor to a pop track or a ballad.
Right. And when that happens, the rules of the game change entirely. You cannot use a plastic pick.
You must use an entirely different instrument, traditionally built from cedar or spruce, and crucially, strung with nylon strings, not steel.
And this is where the physics of tone generation become incredibly intimate. Unlike rock, pop, or country, where you have amplifiers, tubes, and compressor pedals to shape and sustain your tone.
In classical acoustic guitar, your tone is generated entirely by your own physical body.
The shape and the filing of the player's fingernails.
The text explicitly mentions this, and it blew my mind. I never thought about the carpentry of human keratin.
It is a microscopic science. The angle at which you file the nail, the extreme smoothness of the edge, the specific length of the right-hand fingernails extending past the flesh, all of this completely dictates the timbre of the instrument.
If there is even a microscopic jagged edge on the nail, it will catch the nylon string and create a harsh, scratchy, unacceptable overtone that the studio microphones will pick up immediately.
Classical players use multiple grits of incredibly fine sandpaper to polish their nails like glass before a session.
That is insane! And furthermore, the psychological approach to the music is totally inverted.
Classical recording requires a strict, absolute adherence to the composer's written dynamic.
In a rock session, the producer might just say, make it sound huge, and you just play everything loud.
But in classical, the composer has written specific mathematical instructions on the page pianissimo, very soft, in measure 12, and accelerating crescendo, growing louder, in measure 15.
You have to follow the map exactly. There is zero room for the spontaneous, wild improvisation we talked about with Hal Blaine and the country players.
Your job is flawless. dynamic execution of a centuries-old tradition.
It's like being a master chef, you know? You can't just put food on a resume. You have to know that classical French cuisine requires a totally different set of carbon steel knives, a totally different copper pan, and a totally different highly controlled heat source than a traditional rustic Japanese dish or an American barbecue.
How on earth do these players keep this all straight in their heads, sometimes switching between these wildly different styles, gear setups, and mindsets on the exact same day in different studios across town?
It is a testament to the ultimate professional chameleon mindset we discussed earlier. They don't just mimic the styles. They treat every single genre with the deep academic respect for its unique historical and physical anatomy.
But knowing the genre history and bringing the correct amplifier to the studio is really only half the battle.
Because once all the microphones are painstakingly set up, the engineer gives the thumbs up and that red recording light clicks on. The player actually has to decide what notes to play.
And this brings us to one of the most mind-blowing revelations in the entire dissertation.
The reality of the chart.
We talked earlier about sight reading and how it wasn't the main thing.
But I always assumed that when you walk into a million-dollar studio session, there was at least a piece of paper with the specific guitar notes written out by a well-paid composer or arranger.
But the text reveals the shocking truth. Most of the time, in pop, rock, and country, there are no specific notes written down at all.
It's absolutely true. The modern studio guitarist is fundamentally not just an executor of notes. They are a spontaneous, real-time composer.
Steve Lukather, the absolute legend from the band Toto, who played the massive driving guitar riff on Michael Jackson's Beat It and just hundreds of other iconic hits, explains this perfectly in the research.
He says that throughout his entire career, he was rarely given actual sheet music with notes on a staff. Instead, he was just handed a rudimentary chord chart with slashes.
Explain what that looks like to a non-musician.
It's literally just a piece of paper that says C major at the top of a measure, followed by four diagonal slash marks indicating the four beats of that measure. Then the next measure says G minor with four more slashes.
It gives you the bare bones harmonic framework of the song, but it tells you absolutely nothing about how to play it.
It doesn't tell you what rhythm to strum, what register of the guitar to use, whether to play low and heavy or high and delicate, or what specific melodic lines to weave through the chords.
Lukather says he was hired specifically, and I quote from the text, to come up with parts that were better.
The producer or the artist is essentially handing you a skeleton and saying, I have a song structure, I have a basic chord progression, but it sounds boring. I need you to invent the magic that turns this basic skeleton into a multi-platinum hit record.
That sounds utterly terrifying. The creative pressure is immense. You are on the clock. It's $500 an hour.
The producer is staring at you through the control room glass. The lead singer is sitting on the couch judging you. How do you do that? How do you invent the perfect hit-making part out of thin air under that kind of pressure?
You survive by applying the golden rule of studio playing. And nobody articulates this philosophy better than Larry Carlton.
Larry Carlton. Also known as Mr. 335 because of his signature use of the Gibson ES-335 guitar.
He played the iconic sweeping solos on all those pristine Steely Dan records. He worked with Joni Mitchell, Michael Jackson. He's the master of studio taste.
What is his golden rule for spontaneous composing?
Carlton's rule is incredibly disciplined. On the very first run-through of a song in the studio, when the engineer hits play and the rhythm section plays the track down for the first time, do not play.
Wait, do not play a single note. You just sit there with your guitar in your lap.
You sit there, completely silent, and you actively, aggressively listen. Carlton says he uses that crucial first pass to mentally map the entire sonic landscape of the track.
He's asking himself critical architectural questions. Where is the keyboard player putting their left hand? What low frequencies is the bass guitar dominating? Where exactly is the singer's vocal melody moving? Is it high and breathy or low and powerful?
He listens specifically to find out where the holes are in the arrangement.
That requires so much psychological confidence. To sit in a room full of A-list, highly paid musicians and impatient producers while the expensive clock is ticking and just quietly observe.
Most guitarists would want to instantly start noodling to prove why they were hired.
But Carlton is hunting for the specific space where he can actually add structural value rather than just adding cluttered noise.
Exactly. The guitar part must organically emerge from the existing musical context. It cannot precede or overpower it.
And the dissertation provides a truly stunning, granular case study of this exact arranging philosophy in action. It's an iconic, subtle moment from Larry Carlton's session work with the legendary songwriter Joni Mitchell.
Yes. Okay, let's detail this because it perfectly, beautifully illustrates the genius of the studio arranger. It's from Joni Mitchell's song, Help Me.
She sings the lyric, "Help me, I think I'm falling." And right after she sings the word falling, there is a pause in her vocal.
And in that tiny gap, Larry Carlton executes a very simple brushed rake across the guitar strings. Just a soft, descending, cascading chord.
Now let's analyze the restraint there. A lesser player, a guy with a huge ego, might have taken that empty gap in the vocal to play a flashy, lightning-fast blues lick to show off their technique to Joni Mitchell.
They would think, hey, look at me, the singer stop, it's my turn to shine.
Right. But why does Carlton just play a simple, quiet rake across the strings? He explains his exact psychological reasoning in the text.
He says he played that specific, gentle rake because it gives Joni Mitchell's next vocal phrase, which is the lyric, "In Love Again," a solid, beautiful, harmonic pillow to sit down on.
It is brilliant, deeply empathetic arranging. He acts as the emotional connective tissue of the song.
He isn't just accompanying the chords on a piece of paper. He is physically connecting the emotional contour of the lyrics. He is supporting the storyteller, preparing the listener's ear for her landing.
That is profound. It's musical telepathy. But it brings us to what I think is the ultimate paradox of the session player. To do this job successfully, to play the pillow instead of the guitar solo, requires a massive ego check.
It truly does. We have to constantly remember that these session players, people like Larry Carlton, Steve Lukather, Andrew Sinewick, they are absolute virtuosos.
They possess the terrifying technical chops and music theory knowledge to completely outplay almost anyone else in the room. They could shred for hours.
But their entire professional survival, their ability to keep getting hired, depends on extreme musical restraint.
There is a quote in the dissertation from Will Kimbrough, an incredible touring sideman and studio session player. He puts it so bluntly, almost like a religious mantra.
He says, the song is the sacred thing here. It's not about your incredible chops and speed.
And Richard Smith, a veteran LA session player and a professor of studio guitar at the University of Southern California, echoes that exact sentiment when discussing what he teaches his students.
He says the essential factors of becoming a successful studio player are not speed or scales. They are interpretation, interpretation, and interpretation.
It's entirely about getting inside the producer's head and the artist's heart.
Smith says that if you can quickly, accurately formulate the exact guitar part that the producer or the artist is hearing in their head, but maybe doesn't know how to articulate, whether you read it perfectly off a chart or invent it completely on the spot, you will always have a lucrative job.
It is a fundamentally selfless act. You have to check your ego at the heavy studio door.
You are hired to serve and elevate the vision of the artist, absolutely never to showcase your own personal genius at their expense.
Okay, so for decades, this incredible high-wire magic act of listening, reacting, and arranging happened in massive acoustically treated rooms full of heavy, glowing, heat-radiating analog tube amplifiers.
We talked about the Marshall Stacks and the Fender Twins.
You had union cartage companies, literal moving trucks, driving thousands of pounds of gear from studio to studio across Los Angeles and Nashville every single day.
The guitarist would show up, plug into a physical amp, put a physical microphone in front of the speaker, and commit that sound to magnetic analog tape.
Once it was on tape, it was permanent. But today, the physical and economic reality of this job has fundamentally, irreversibly changed.
The digital revolution has fully arrived in the recording studio, and it has fractured the way these musicians work, the way they get paid, and how they think about sound.
We are entering the final era of the dissertation's focus, present-day practices, amps versus algorithms.
The days of hauling a refrigerator-sized rack of effects and three fragile, heavy tube amplifiers in a cartage truck are rapidly ending for many sessions.
Enter the era of digital modeling.
This is a massive industry-wide paradigm shift. The text focuses on high-end digital hardware units like the Kemper Profiler, the Neural DSP Quad Cortex, the Tonex system, and these incredible compact universal audio amplifier modeling pedals like the Dream 65, which models a Fender amp, or the Ruby 63, which models a Vox amp.
I've seen these things on modern pedal boards, but what exactly do these digital boxes do internally? Are they just fancy equalization pedals?
No, it's far more complex than EQ. They use highly advanced computer algorithms and machine learning to perfectly, mathematically simulate the complex electrical and acoustic properties of physical tube amplifiers.
They model exactly how the analog vacuum tubes react to voltage, how the paper speaker cones physically push air in a room, how the specific vintage microphone captures that moving air, and even how the microphone preamp colors the sound.
And they pack all of that massive computational data into a small metal box the size of a paperback book.
So a studio guitarist today can literally carry a backpack into a major studio session, pull out a pedal, plug a standard USB cord or a line cable directly into the studio's recording computer, and instantly access the exact microscopic sound of a pristine 1960s Vox amp or a roaring 1980s Marshall stack with absolutely zero setup time, zero heavy lifting, and zero microphones required.
Exactly. From a pure business and engineering standpoint, it offers unprecedented efficiency and ultimate flexibility. It allows for a process called going direct, or DI direct injection.
The guitarist records a completely clean, dry, unamplified signal directly into the computer while listening to the digital amplifier model in their headphones.
Because the clean signal is captured, the producer can actually change the entire amplifier sound digitally after the guitarist has packed up and gone home.
Wait, the producer can sit there the next day and say, you know what, the player's physical performance was absolutely perfect, the notes were great, but looking at the mix now, I really wish he had played through a clean Fender instead of a distorted Marshall.
And they just click a mouse, change a plug-in, and the amplifier physically morphs, but the original human performance remains perfectly intact. That is wild.
It is ultimate control for the producer. But as the dissertation extensively reveals, not everyone is thrilled about this new infinite workflow.
There's a very real generational and deeply philosophical divide happening right now among the top-tier players regarding technology.
Yes, the text beautifully contrasts two prominent interviewees who represent the absolute opposite sides of this technological coin. On one side, you have J.D. Simo, a fantastic, highly respected Nashville-based guitarist. He firmly represents the traditionalist analog perspective.
Simo is very vocal about his workflow. He says he basically ignores all the new digital modeling technology. He vastly prefers the old permanent methods. A real wood and wire guitar, a real glowing tube amplifier, a real microphone placed carefully in an acoustic room recorded commonly to a track.
And his reasoning isn't just stubborn nostalgia. It is deeply psychological. He says that having a digital box with 10,000 different amplifier options, hundreds of microphone placements, and infinite post-production tweakability gives him crippling option anxiety.
Option anxiety. It's a very real psychological phenomenon, often called the paradox of choice.
I deeply empathize with option anxiety. Think about the stakes. In the old days, you plug into a Fender amp, you turned the treble knob until it sounded good in the room, you hit record, the sound was printed to tape, and you had to live with it. You moved on to the next problem.
But today, when you can choose literally any guitar sound in the history of the world with the click of a mouse, and you know you can change it tomorrow, how do you ever fully commit to a sound? How do you just make a firm creative decision and play the damn song with conviction?
You lose the finality that drives art. For a traditionalist like Simo, limitations breed creativity. The friction of the physical world forces you to play better. You plug into one amp, you turn it up, you accept its flaws, and you make it work with the touch of your hands and the emotion of your performance.
Exactly. It forces you to commit. But on the exact opposite side of the spectrum, the dissertation highlights Andrew Sinowik, representing the highly adaptable, modern hybrid approach working in the fast-paced Los Angeles scene.
Sinowik's approach is fascinating because he isn't anti-analog. He explicitly says that he absolutely loves real tube amps. If a big-budget film score has a dedicated cartage budget to hire union movers to haul his massive physical gear to a soundstage, he will gladly bring his physical amplifiers because they are incredibly fun to play and they push real air.
But fundamentally, he is a pragmatist, a realist surviving in a shifting economy.
Yes. He understands that the modern studio workflow, especially with shrinking budgets and the rise of remote recording where artists aren't even in the same city, often demands brutal speed and ultimate post-production flexibility.
He frequently records direct. He has all the high-end digital modeling options, the Kempers, the plugins, ready to go on his computer, because producers simply demand that workflow now.
He says in the text, "A lot of people are going to need me to go direct, so I have all of that stuff too." He doesn't fight the tide. He adapts to the technological demands of the producer just as fluidly and egolessly as he adapts to the musical genres.
Which perfectly, beautifully encapsulates the core thesis of Luis Alberto da Silva's entire dissertation.
It really does. So what does this all mean for you, the listener, trying to understand how the music you love is actually manufactured today?
It means that in the modern music industry, adaptability is no longer just about musical style. It's not just about knowing the chord changes to a jazz standard versus a rock anthem.
Adaptability today is about technological and psychological workflow. It's about surviving in an industry that demands instant, flawless results, remote recording sessions sent over email, and infinite post-production tweaks.
To synthesize all of this incredible research, the contemporary studio guitarist is absolutely not a human jukebox. They are not mindless robotic sight-reading machines churning out black dots on a page.
They are real-time, high-stakes problem solvers. They are highly empathetic listeners. They are spontaneous, on-the-spot composers operating under immense financial and creative pressure.
Their true, undeniable genius is their adaptability. Whether that means mathematically dropping the third from a distorted rock chord to physically prevent sonic artifacts from ruining a mix, or using a specialized compressor pedal to perfectly articulate a blazing country chicken-picking lick, or having the incredible egoless restraint to sit in a room with a musical icon like Joni Mitchell and decide to not play a single note until the second take.
They are the ultimate musical chameleons. They constantly mold themselves physically and psychologically to perfectly serve the vision of the artist, the demands of the producer, and the ultimate needs of the song itself.
So next time you are driving down the highway and you listen to a pristine, heavily produced pop track, or a massive, heavy rock anthem, or a deeply emotional country ballad, I want you to listen past the lead singer.
Listen deeper into the mix. Listen for that subtle brushed string rake right after a vocal phrase. Listen for the muted percussive funk scratch locking in perfectly with the snare drum. Listen for the perfectly timed echo trailing off into the silence of a ballad.
That is the sound of a master chameleon at work, solving a puzzle you didn't even know existed.
It completely changes how you experience a record once you know exactly what to listen for and what it took to put that sound there.
It really does. It's like seeing the code in the Matrix.
And I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over as we wrap this up. Think about everything we've just unpacked regarding the psychology of the session player. If the ultimate goal of the studio musician is to perfectly serve the song, to blend seamlessly into the artist's vision, to never step on the vocal, and to essentially become whatever the track needs them to be. Does that mean the highest level of mastery in this profession is actually becoming invisible?
We spend so much time in our culture celebrating artists for standing out, for being loud, for demanding the spotlight, and having a unique, unchangeable brand.
But maybe, just maybe, the truest, purest form of musical genius is the ability to completely disappear into the art.
It is a profound way to look at it, the absolute art of invisibility.
Thank you so much for taking this deep dive into the source material with us today. Keep listening deeply, keep questioning what you hear, and we will catch you on the next one.